quite interesting. Renewable resources. How do you take the land? Holy war. And holy war is not like regular war. There are specific laws that the Bible, injunctions that the Bible lays down to tell people how to engage in a battle being fought on God's behalf. For example, you always bring the troops into battle. This is the modern English, praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. A priest will be there. Indeed, often the Israelites would bring the holy ark into battle with them. Officers are required to discharge certain people. For example, if a man has just built a new home, but he hasn't had much occasion to live in it. If he has just planted a vineyard, but has not enjoyed the fruits, literally, of his labor. If he has become engaged, but has not yet gotten married. And, of course, the faint-hearted are discharged. So we have the 4F version from the Bible. Ordinances are then made against uncontrolled destruction. For example, the first initiative is that the rulers should be offered terms of a truce. The initiator of the holy war here, Joshua, is to go to the rulers and say, we will come take over your land and put you in forced labor. Do you agree? And if they agree, then that's fine. We wind up with slaves. But if they don't, one can engage in war. But at least there's a possibility of a treaty here. If surrender is denied, all adult males are to be killed. Trees are not to be cut down. This is like the modern Spark bomb. It kills people, but it doesn't kill natural resources. If a woman is taken captive, she is to be allowed 1 month to mourn her dead family members, and this prohibits rape, right? She may then become the soldier's wife. But if he decides he does not like her, he is not permitted to sell her off as a slave or indeed to treat her like a slave. If he takes a woman captive and she becomes his wife, she is legally his wife. She's not some sort of second-order product. Soldiers are required to be ritually pure in the same way they had to be ritually pure when they stood before Mount Sinai, which means they cannot engage in sexual intercourse. And I mention this now because it will become very important when we get to the story of David and Bathsheba. We are told, any town that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, any town in Canaan, you must not let anything that breathes in it remain alive. Total destruction. The irony is, when we actually look at what Joshua does, the first major campaign is the campaign against Jericho. And indeed, surviving Jericho is Rahab the prostitute and her family. So although there is an injunction, destroy everybody, it turns out these injunctions are not necessarily heeded, even by characters in the narrative. But these are the general laws, and so the Israelites prepare to enter Canaan under Joshua. Now, if you read the book of Joshua quickly, and you don't look at the footnotes, and you don't really pay a whole lot of attention, it looks like the book is presenting a blitzkrieg. Joshua and the Israelites get into the land, conquer Jericho, conquer the city of Ai, make it all the way through, and finally at the end they make a covenant renewal ceremony at Shechem. Everything worked perfectly well. There were no glitches. This was the greatest battle program ever enjoined. And in fact, if we've been reading the Bible through, this is what we would have expected. We know the patriarchs had promises that they were going to get the land. Joshua fulfills those promises. Indeed, some biblical scholars have argued that what we have in the biblical text is not a Pentateuch, a five-book beginning, but rather a Hexateuch, a six-book beginning, with Joshua showing the fulfillment of the promises made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Not only does this blitzkrieg model seem to fit with what we would expect to have had happen based on the promises, but one can very cautiously, very, very cautiously, perhaps match up Joshua's conquests with external historical evidence. It's extremely tentative, but here's how it works. I'm going to go step by step because I have to use math here, and math is not my strong point. Step one, there's a group of Asiatics. They're called Hyksos. The name actually means rulers of foreign lands. Interesting name for a group. They're from Syria, Palestine, and they move into Egypt around 1720, 1710. That's more or less the time frame for Joseph to have been the Grand Vizier. Perhaps background for Joseph, perhaps not. With the rise of Egypt's 18th dynasty in 1570, the Hyksos are expelled from Egypt. That's step two. And the native Egyptians take over. That may be the rationale for why Exodus talks about a Pharaoh arose who knew not Joseph, because perhaps this new group of pharaohs are not from the Hyksos ethnic group, and they don't retain the same historical memories. That's step two.